Hello there. Another Conservative has gone.
Because I believe with my heart and soul that a better future is possible for us, I am joining Reform UK.
Former Home Secretary Suella Braverman becomes the third high-profile Tory in the last 2 weeks to join Nigel Farage. We'll have reaction from her former party, also on PM.
A massacre is unfolding in Iran and more than 30,000 innocent people, unarmed people, defenseless people have been killed in front of the eyes of their family members.
What is happening in Iran? Some staggeringly high casualty figures are being reported. There is still an internet blackout, but we hear from prominent activists exiled in America. The government have announced what's been described as one of the biggest shake-ups for decades in policing. We'll have a briefing on that. And
BBC Television, this is the switchboard of picture page. You're looking at Pipe Major Massey, the bagpipes man from Trafalgar Square.
You probably don't remember the early television broadcast, but guess what? It's 100 years now since John Logie Baird demonstrated the idea of TV. We'll discuss the television, the technology and its impact, past and present. We'll start, though, with the BBC News read today by Ron Brown.
The former Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, has become the third Conservative MP to defect to Reform UK this month. She accused her former party of betrayal in relation to a promise to reduce immigration. The Conservatives said Nigel Farage's party was doing their spring cleaning. Labour said Mr Farage was stuffing his party full of failed Tories. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
I feel like I've come home. Those were the words of the one-time Conservative Home Secretary when she joined Nigel Farage on stage. Mrs Braverman accused her former party of betrayal and said she was calling time on Tory lies. She was appointed Home Secretary twice and forced to stand down twice for sharing official documents on a personal email account and then for accusing the Metropolitan Police of bias. But she brings experience of one of the big offices of state. The Conservatives' initial response referred to Mrs Braverman's mental health, saying the party had done all it could to look after her. After significant criticism, the Conservatives removed that reference.
The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has said that every police force in England and Wales will be able to use live facial recognition vans. In her common speech outlining the biggest shake-up of policing in decades, she said the number of vans would rise from 10 to 50 to help catch criminals. She said some forces were fighting crime in a digital age with analogue methods. The Conservatives said the statement did nothing to address total police numbers, which they said were falling. Israel says it has recovered the remains of the last Israeli hostage from Gaza. Ran Gvili was a policeman whose body was taken to Gaza after he was killed in the October the 7th attacks in 2023. Yesterday, Israel said its military was searching for his body in a cemetery in northern Gaza. The UK has lost its status as a country that's eliminated measles. The World Health Organization said the viral infection was re-established in the UK in 2024. Here's our health correspondent Nick Triggle.
Being measles-free means there's no sustained transmission and there are high rates of vaccination. On both counts, the UK is now judged to be lacking. Cases started rising in late 2023 before a surge in the following year, which led to this announcement. As well as recording 3,600 suspected cases in 2024, vaccination rates were well below the 95% threshold needed for herd immunity. The UK was first declared measles-free in 2017, before losing the status 2 years later, but regained it during the pandemic as a result of social distancing.
President Trump has said he's sending his border czar, Tom Homan, to Minnesota, where the killing of a nurse by federal immigration agents has caused outrage. Alex Pretty was shot dead on Saturday, just over 2 weeks after Rene Good was also killed by immigration officials. Mr. Trump also said that he'd been called by the Democratic governor of Minnesota, Tim Walz, with a request to work together and that the two had been on a similar wavelength. An inquest has found that heading a football was a factor in the death of the former Scotland defender Gordon McQueen. The coroner, sitting in North Yorkshire, said repetitive head impacts were likely to have contributed to his brain injuries. McQueen had been diagnosed with vascular dementia before his death in 2023 at the age of 70. Our correspondent Katie Gornall reports.
The senior coroner, John Heath, told the inquest in Northallerton he was satisfied that the brain disease, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, had contributed to Gordon McQueen's death from pneumonia and dementia in 2023. He went on to draw a link to football, saying, "It is likely that repetitive head impacts sustained by heading the ball while playing contributed to the CTE." Last month, the inquest heard from McQueen's daughter, the broadcaster Hayley McQueen. She told the hearing that her father had himself acknowledged heading a football for all those years probably hasn't helped.
Katie Gornall reporting.
Thank you, Ron. Well, a weekend of drama in the Labour Party is followed by another day of drama on the right of British politics with another high-profile defection to Reform UK. Always something political going on at the moment, but we're in a pretty significant redrawing of the landscape that's underway, which means you would expect lots of coming and goings. Suella Braverman is the Reform Party's eighth MP now. Half of those MPs are defectors since the last election from the Tories. And she announced her defection on stage with Reform leader Nigel Farage earlier.
Oh, done it. Done it. I resigned the Conservative and my party membership, a party membership of 30 years. It's gone. It's over today. And because I believe with my heart and soul that a better future is possible for us, I am joining Reform UK.
Now, right now, in fact, Nigel Farage has just gone on stage. He is holding a press conference. Let's just dip into what he is saying live.
Thank you, Nigel.
Oh, it's very, Suella.
Very kind of you. Very good to see all of you this afternoon. As I said this morning, this feels like coming home. And I am incredibly grateful for the welcome, the support, and the fact that I am finally part of a mission that I can believe in. Because the truth is, for the first time in years, I now feel that I can truly believe in something. And the truth is, as I said to our veterans on earlier this morning, our country is broken and only Reform UK can fix it. That is why I've left the Conservatives and I have joined Reform today. Now, I've not taken this decision lightly. I very much understand why there will be some people, particularly in Fareham Waterlooville Conservatives, who have supported me over the years, who will be feeling disappointed and upset. And I want to say to them that this is not about you. To those local supporters who have confided in me about their frustrations with the Conservative Party, but who have only stayed put because of me, please join me. Come and join Reform UK.
So there's Suella Braverman on stage at a press conference with Nigel Farage there live, some hours after she announced her defection. She was perhaps the least surprising Conservative defection to Reform. She was very, very much on the right. Her husband has been tweeting anti-Tory pro-Reform lines in recent weeks. He had, in fact, joined Reform and then he left last year after the party attacked Suella Braverman's record at the Home Office. He's now rejoined as well, so the Braverman couple are together again there. There's been a bit of drama in the Conservative Party response this afternoon because the party has found different lines of attack on the prominent defectors. One wanted a peerage but was denied it. One wanted the leadership but knew it wasn't going to be available. Here was today's original attack line read by a colleague.
It was always a matter of when, not if, Suella would defect. The Conservatives did all we could to look after Suella's mental health, but she was clearly very unhappy.
Well, the reference to mental health was widely derided as a very low blow, and the party subsequently removed that line, saying it had been released in error. Here's the rest of the Conservative statement about Suella Braverman's defection.
She says she feels that she has come home, which will come as a surprise to the people who chose not to elect a Reform MP in her constituency in 2024. There are some people who are MPs because they care about their communities and want to deliver a better country. There are others who do it for their personal ambition. Suella stood for leader of the Conservatives in 2022 and came sixth, behind Kemi and Tom Tugendhat. In 2024, she could not even muster enough supporters to get on the ballot. She has now decided to try her luck with Nigel Farage, who said last year he didn't want her in Reform. They really are doing our spring cleaning.
Doing our spring cleaning. Now, some centrist Conservatives have welcomed Suella Braverman's defection, thinking it's good for the Conservative Party to be purged of the right. Is it politically good for the Conservatives or bad? James Johnson is pollster from JL Partners. How are you reading it, James?
Yeah, look, I think this is only good news for Reform. They've gained another Conservative MP, and to understand why that's a good thing for them, just zoom out a moment and have a look at the numbers. Reform have half of their vote are these voters that have defined British politics over the last decade. Older, more working class, more likely not to have gone to university than not than having done so, and voted Leave in the Brexit referendum. Those voters constitute half of Reform's current vote, and there's more of them out there to win. Now, only 5% of Labour's current vote are made up of voters like that, compared to one in four, 25% of current Tory voters. So there are more of those voters to win for Reform, and you can see why more Conservative figures helps Nigel Farage to reach out to those voters. So look, I think from Reform's perspective, this wins the more Tory voters, not overnight, not immediately, but over the coming weeks and months.
And so for those centrist Tories who say, good riddance, Suella Braverman, we can now be a more centre-right party and not tempted into the terrain that Reform is perhaps pulling us, you would say they're not going to create, it's less likely they're creating a winning coalition as a result of this.
I think the Conservative Party going full tilt to the sort of old Cameroon sort of centrism of 10 years ago or so is a mistake. More than a mistake, I think it's electoral madness. And the reason why is that Conservatives have won by winning centrist voters before, but when they've also had the right of the British electorate as their core level of support, it's quite hard to fan out into the centre if you don't have that core. It's a bit like trying to grow a tree without a trunk. Conservatives without their core right-wing vote, it's very difficult for them to win. They had a 1-2 punch. They lost a quarter of their vote to Reform at the 2024 general election, and they've lost another quarter of their vote to Reform since the 2024 general election. I can't see how the maths adds up for the Conservatives without them winning those voters back first. And that's why I think this tact the centre policy is misled.
Really interesting analysis. James, thanks for that. James Johnson, pollster from JL Partners. Let's talk to Sabina Jenkin, former Conservative MP for Harwich and North Essex. Sir Bernard, thank you for joining us. Well, first of all, I think you were really one of Suella Braverman's backers when she was pursuing the leadership, weren't you?
I did a long time ago. I think it was 2017. I mean, she was the one person who was clear about the ECHR issue, and was the only leadership candidate at that point. Kemi wasn't standing in that election. But we've changed our position on that, and it's rather odd that she's leaving the party now that we've adopted her position on the European Convention on Human Rights. But I think you're right. This one really doesn't come as a surprise. But can I just really take issue the idea that we're sort of tacking to the left? I mean, that's complete nonsense. What we have is a number of individuals who were not in the mainstream of the Conservative Party by any stretch of the imagination, who have decided, each for their own reasons, to leave the Conservative Party. I do think it's ironic that recent defections have occurred when Kemi is clearly doing very much better. She's overtaken Nigel Farage in the polls, personally, and we're closing the gap on Reform at the moment. So these defections aren't necessarily winning, as your pollster says, any instant support. And it may be they don't win any support. I don't see a lot of voters flocking to Reform just because of Suella Braverman. So I think this is all, I mean, it's a Westminster Village story, isn't it?
Well, I suppose it's just that Reform is clearer about its positioning than the Conservative Party. In the sense
who's its defence spokesman?
Well, obviously it hasn't got a shadow cabinet, but it knows it's right wing, whereas your party is divided.
What's their policy on Russia?
Okay.
What's their policy on welfare? They want to spend more on welfare.
And certainly they've been against the two-child cap, as Suella Braverman was, the two-child benefit cap. But I suppose
she wants to abolish that. which means spending more on welfare.
Your party, I suppose, is a coalition between centrists who say Suella Braverman shouldn't be in our party and people who think she should be in your party.
There's always a place for anybody respectable on the right to be in the Conservative Party. To that extent, I'm sorry to lose Suella. But Kemi's been very, very clear. We want team players. We don't want people who are thinking about their own personal agendas. And I recognise that anybody who defects, it's a personal dilemma for them. But I think they confront themselves with the wrong dilemma. Kemi is now doing well for the Conservative Party. And the next election is still a long way off. I remember you will too, the SDP in the early 1980s. They were 50% in the polls. And they only won a handful of seats at the subsequent general election. Now, there are all sorts of different reasons one can give for that. But the point is, what is happening in the polls now is absolutely no indication as to what might happen in a general election. For you to describe this as a general realignment, it's far too soon to say.
I'm gathering from what you're saying, Sir Bernard, you're not thinking of going over to Reform.
No, I've talked to one or two of those who've gone over, and one or two of particular friends, and I've lamented with them that I think they have made a misjudgment. I understand why they've made that judgment, but I think they have misjudged the whole thing. If anything, I mean, using the terms that actually Kemi herself doesn't really like to use, left, right, she could be described as having taken the party to the right. The stance on immigration, the stance on the European Convention of Human Rights, the determination not to tangle with Labour's reset with the European Union and start giving up control to the European Union again. And what we've got in the Conservative Party is a new group of people who really would be described in conventional Westminster Village terms as on the left of the Conservative Party, who seem to be saying that we've swung too far in the wrong direction. Actually, what Kemi is a person of principle and intellect who wants to do the right thing for our party, regardless of left or right. And the party that wins the next general election will be the one that can both offer learning from the mistakes of previous years, radical action to put things right, but not someone who runs the country down and says the whole thing's broken, but is prepared to do radical and brave things like cut welfare, cut public spending, cut taxation, spend more on defence, and balance the books. Easy to say, but very difficult to do. But that's what we're going to have to do.
Sir Bernard, thanks so much. And I apologise. I, just out of habit, said former Conservative MP. But you're not a former Conservative MP. You're an existing Conservative MP for Harwich.
Thank you.
And North Essex. And I do apologise for saying this. Thank you. And it's not even written in my script. I just slipped it in.
It's Harwich and North Essex now. I have quite a red wall constituency in some respects. I finished up with a very close result.
Good to talk to you. Thank you, Sir Bernard. Now, later in the programme, we have our regular AI clinic with our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman. We talk about in these spots AI and its applications, uses and misuses. And today we wanted to talk about AI and the afterlife. Now, there are various aspects of this, but you may have aspects you have tried. For example, keeping memories alive of a loved one after they have died. If you have questions or any experiences to relate, we'd love to hear from you. pm@bbc.co.uk. That'll be in about half an hour on the programme. Right now, though, it's 19 minutes past five, and Ron will give us another look at some headlines.
The European Commission is investigating the social media platform X because of concerns that its artificial intelligence tool, Grok, is being used to create sexualised images of real people. The UK watchdog Ofcom announced a similar probe earlier this month. Three people have been charged in relation to alleged chants calling for an intifada at a protest in London on December the 17th, the day when the Metropolitan Police announced a change in its approach to the slogan. And a study of nearly 3,000 grandparents in England has found that those who provide care for their grandchildren tend to show better cognitive functioning than those who don't.
Thank you, Ron. Now, the US, and in particular the state of Minnesota, are reeling still from the killing over the weekend of Alex Pretty, an ICU nurse, by ICE personnel, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. There's been some unease among Republicans as well as Democrats, and the administration's reaction was to assert Mr. Pretty was a would-be assassin and saying he had committed an act of domestic terrorism. They don't Doesn't seem to be any evidence for that at all. President Trump said he was going to be sending Tom Homan, his border czar, to Minnesota today to run immigration enforcement operations, which might be taken as some sign of a step towards de-escalation of tensions on that front. Sarah Smith is our North America editor. And Sarah, talk us through the reaction to this, because this is the second citizen protester killed, shot by ICE officials, with video evidence very largely at odds with the official narrative.
Exactly. Very quickly after this happened on Saturday morning, as you said, we had administration officials describing Alex Petty as a domestic terrorist and saying that he had set out to massacre law enforcement, claiming that he was brandishing a gun at some of the ICE agents. Whereas the videos that can be easily viewed on social media show that, in fact, it was a mobile phone that he had in his hand and he was filming ICE agents who tackled him to the ground. And he was pinned to the ground by several agents when he was shot by two of them in the back, and it was difficult to see how he could have been threatening them in any way.
Yeah, he did.
And that has produced much more of a backlash from Republicans.
Yeah, I was just going to say they did take a gun from him. He did have a licensed weapon, but wasn't brandishing it in the video.
That's right. It was in a holster on his hip, and one of the agents who found it removed it from him before he was shot. But the fact that some people, like the head of the FBI, were saying that he had no right to bring a gun to a protest has upset not just Republicans, but all sorts of people on the right who believe in Americans' right to bear arms in the Second Amendment of the Constitution. So you have the National Rifle Agency and other people who are usually on Donald Trump's side on a lot of these things and speaking out quite forcefully about the administration's reaction to that. But it's seeing the video and seeing somebody who Republican lawmakers themselves have described as an innocent protester being shot dead by ICE agents that have really provoked a bit of a backlash. And you have Republican lawmakers in Congress who don't normally speak out against the president, saying that they find this incredibly disturbing and that describing this as possible federal intimidation of Americans, some governors as well speaking out. And that seems to have provoked a change of behaviour from Donald Trump, who's been pretty measured compared to others in his administration about what he's said about this. And he has, as you were saying earlier, sent Tom Homan, his border czar, to take charge of the ICE operation in Minneapolis in an attempt to de-escalate what's going on there and try and make sure there isn't another incident like this. Just in the last few minutes, he's posted on social media that he's spoken to the Democratic governor, Tim Walz, who has been very critical of the ICE operation there. And he said, we seem to be on a similar wavelength. So he has been saying things to Tim Walz that he has his administration have not been saying publicly, if they can find the same wavelength.
Yeah, I mean, that does sound like de-escalatory measure. We should say, Sarah, I mean, on social media, put aside the two tragic deaths this month, there are incidents happening day after day which are posted, are filmed, of brutal encounters between ICE personnel and citizens in which, for example, they're tapping on the window saying, where are you born? And people saying, I'm not opening my window. And then they break the window of the car. I just wonder how comfortable Trump's America is with what they're seeing and the video they're seeing on social media.
Yeah, I mean, you're right about many, many disturbing incidents. People being dragged out of their homes in their underwear into the bitter cold, only for the agents to discover that it's not the person that they were targeting at all, and it is an American citizen. 5-year-old children being detained, all kinds of shocking things that you can see on the media and on social media. And so there is a growing unease about this. Americans have a higher tolerance for violence from law enforcement and a degree of roughhousing than we would have in the UK. So they are prepared to put up with a certain amount of this before they're shocked enough to provoke a change. But I think we have crossed that boundary here. And the second shooting in circumstances which seem to be even more clear-cut than the killing of Renee Good a couple of weeks ago, I think is a turning point. And that although other members of the administration administration did not realise that. Donald Trump has acutely sensed that they need to pull back now. And if he is to save his immigration crackdown and what political wins he thinks he has from the strong enforcement of trying to get as many illegal aliens and especially people with criminal convictions out of the country, then there can't be any more scenes like this on the streets of America. Because at the moment, polls suggest that most people do approve of the idea of cracking down on people who are in the United States without the lawful right to remain, but that a majority of people are now deeply concerned about the tactics they see being used by ICE agents. So, yes, if the administration wishes to carry on expelling as many people as they can, I think they've realised that the tactics have to change, otherwise it's going to provoke a popular backlash.
Sarah, thanks for that. Sarah Smith. Well, let's talk about policing here after that. The government has confirmed its plans to reform police services in England and Wales. There will be fewer police forces. No figure has been put on that yet, from the current number of 43 down to X. New local policing areas with local officers focusing on neighbourhood policing. A new national policing service, often likened to the FBI in the home in the US. Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood set out her vision to the Commons an hour ago.
These are, without question, major reforms. A transformation in the structures of our forces, the standards within them, and the means by which they are held to account by the public. These are the most significant changes to how policing works in this country in around 200 years. The world has changed immeasurably since then, but policing has not.
200 years. Well, Danny Shaw, police and crime commentator, is a former advisor to Yvette Cooper, who was Home Secretary before Shabana Mahmood, and he's with me in the studio. So this is a fairly ambitious piece, but can we just talk about the organisation of policing? At the moment, we have the Met, which is completely dominant, and we have, let's call them county police forces or thereabouts. How does it look under the reform?
The Met will lose some powers under this because it will be stripped of its responsibility for counter-terrorism policing. That will move to this big new body, the National Police Service. This is going to be a mammoth organisation, not just counter-terrorism policing. It will also encompass the National Crime Agency. It will take on fraud. It will have a new forensic service, and lots of other functions will move into that new body. That is a major change. As well as that, the other forces outside London, the other 42 forces, some of those will be merged. We don't know the number yet. There's going to be a review that will report by the summer to tell us how that's going to look. The idea is that this will make policing more efficient. It will save money and also make policing more effective. So these bigger, smaller number of forces can share specialist facilities like firearms commands and digital forensics, that kind of thing. Their capability will improve, it is hoped, under this new model.
But everybody says what the public really want is local policing, much more neighbourhood policing, where you might know the name of a local policeman, not someone who's in a yet more distant office away from you. So how do you get that in this structure?
Well, the Home Office is saying that that is not going to change, in as much as you will still have a community policing team, a neighbourhood policing team. There'll be investment into neighbourhood policing. There is going to be 13,000 extra police officers and community support officers deployed into neighbourhoods by the end of this parliament, and there will be a ring-fence fund to guarantee that. And there will be these local policing areas within each force which will focus on those neighbourhood crimes, antisocial behaviour and so on. So there will still be a link between the person and their local police force, but at a bigger level, at a wider level, you know, there will be more join-up. And I think that's the key thing. At the moment, the policing landscape in England and Wales is cluttered with these bodies and organisations bolted on here and there. That will now come under this new body with bigger local forces.
Danny, they did something, I mean, not quite like this, but Scotland has been yes. through a reform of this kind. They moved to a national Scottish police service.
Yes.
Did it work?
They moved from 8 constabularies to 1 to Police Scotland. They have saved a huge amount of money over 10 years, estimated about £2 billion. But there were some serious teething problems. It was done quite quickly, within about a year or so. What the officials are saying about this is that this is going to be a much more gradual process. It could take, you know, up to 8 years, in fact, before it's completed. And therefore, they will consult with people, they'll go slowly, and they'll make it work more effectively. But the problem with that is if you go slow, you can lose the impetus, the drive to change. There could be a new government in 3 years' time, Evan.
The reform is reformed.
Sweep it all away.
Been reformed and instilled. Danny Shaw, thank you very much. Danny Shaw. Now, scientists have this afternoon published a map of the dark matter that threads its way through the universe. The map is higher resolution than anything that's gone before, showing the influence of dark matter on the formation of stars, galaxies and planets. Now, I grant this is a more impressive breakthrough for scientists who've mastered exactly what dark matter is. But as it is now understood to be a huge component of the universe, we should all try and get to know it better. There's more dark matter than ordinary matter on the current understanding. Let us talk to Professor Richard Massey, co-author of the research, works in the Institute for Computational Cosmology at Durham University, Durham having been involved in producing this map. Richard, thanks for talking to us. I think we just need the kind of beginner's guide to the difference between matter as we understand it and dark matter.
Well, sadly, we don't actually know. What you said was completely right, but we don't actually know what it is yet. We do know that there's lots more of it than everything else. So for all of the, you know, everything that we're made out of, all everything that we can see around us, all of the carbon and oxygen and water and everything like that that we can see, there's about five times as much of dark matter. And we don't know what it is. We're beginning to figure out where it is. And that's what our map is. It's a, the first thing that you do when you explore a new landscape is map out the lie of the land. But now we've figured out what it is. What now we've figured out where it is. Yeah, we've still got that big question about what on earth is it?
And you have figured out where it is because you can see the impact it has on gravity. So planets might have mysterious movements. They're being tugged in a particular way from something that isn't there. And that's you telling, that tells you there must be some dark matter there.
Exactly that. I mean, we know lots of things that dark matter doesn't do. It's completely transparent. It's invisible, so we can't see it itself. But you're right. I mean, well, there are lots of things that we can't see. You know, you can look out the window and you can't see the wind, but you can see it pulling the leaves around and blowing the trees from side to side. Dark matter is the same sort of thing. It has gravity. There's so much of it. It's really heavy. And it pulls stuff around. It pulls things around that we can see. And we know that it's there from what we infer from the things that we can see. And for sure is a lot of it. We don't know exactly how it behaves. We don't know yet what it's useful for, but it has shaped our universe.
I mean, tell us about the map. So you basically, I don't know how big the map is or how far it goes, but what sort of do we mean by a map?
So it's about three times the size of the full moon, and it goes from the Earth all the way back 13 billion light years away to the other side of the universe. So it's very long and thin map, if you like. We're coming on later to sort of make a one that's all around us, but for the moment we've got this map, and it's almost the structures of dark matter that we see in it are a bit like a sink full of full of soap bubbles. So the next time you do the washing up, get a load of lather going, and wherever there's a soap bubble, we see something like that in the dark matter. So the sort of strings and little walls of dark matter, but then between them, absolutely nothing. And at some level, the terrifying thing is that there's these huge patches of the universe that contain absolutely nothing. And our map is big enough to see those sort of scary voids.
I mean, it is amazing. You must reflect on this sometimes, Richard. I mean, just how little we still know. And yet we do know a lot. And compared to 100 years ago, we know the most extraordinary amount. And we have these fantastic, fantastic telescopes like James Webb telescope that will give us pictures going back almost to the beginning of the universe. And yet, really basic things we still don't have any understanding of.
Yeah, I mean, if some alien came to our universe, they'd see all this dark matter floating around. And there's so much of it. If they had sort of dark matter goggles, they'd think of the universe as being made by dark matter. They wouldn't perhaps even necessarily notice the sort of flotsam and jetsam floating around on the top of it, which is, sadly, us.
Richard Massey, thank you so much. Richard Massey from Durham University.
The buzz when I go for a run and I have an idea.
I'm John Wilson, and on This Cultural Life, I meet some of the world's leading artistic figures to explore the people, the places, and the cultural works that have inspired them. So far in this series, we've heard from comedian and actor Ricky Gervais, photographer Annie Leibovitz, and in the next episode, discussing his life on stage and screen, actor Jonathan Pryce.
How I got into performing and acting was there were more people saying they liked my acting than had ever said they liked my painting.
Listen to This Cultural Life, Thursday mornings at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Right now, it's 26 minutes to 6. You're listening to PM. We'll have a summary of the news from Ron Brown.
The former Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, has defected from the Conservatives to Reform UK, the third sitting MP to do so this month. It brings the total number of Reform MPs to 8. During a news conference in the past half hour, she accused her former party of a number of great betrayals. A Conservative statement said her defection had been a matter of when, not if, and had also made a reference to looking after her mental health, which was subsequently withdrawn. Mrs. Braverman said those attacks said more about the Tories than they did about her. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has said that every police force in England and Wales will be able to use live facial recognition vans. She said the number of vans would rise from 10 to 50 and said some forces had been fighting crime in a digital age with analogue methods. Israel says it has recovered the remains of the last hostage from Gaza, a central condition of the ceasefire with Hamas. Ran Gvili was a policeman whose body was taken to Gaza after he was killed in the October the 7th attacks. President Trump says he's spoken on the phone to the Democratic governor of Minnesota, Tim Walz, about the situation in the state, where federal immigration agents have shot dead two American citizens this month. Mr. Trump has been facing calls from within his own Republican Party for an inquiry. The president said it was a good call, and he and Governor Walz seemed to be on a similar wavelength. An inquest has found that heading a football was a factor in the death of the former Scotland defender Gordon McQueen. The coroner, sitting in North Yorkshire, said the repetitive head impacts were likely to have contributed to the brain injury suffered by McQueen, who played for both Manchester United and Leeds United during his 16-year career.
Thank you, Ron. A US aircraft carrier, the Abraham Lincoln, along with accompanying warships, have arrived in the Middle East. It is putting US firepower within range of Iran. Certainly the Iranian authorities see it as a potential threat. They've warned of bloodshed should the US get involved in that country's affairs. Meanwhile, how many have died in recent weeks of protest and repression? Some staggeringly large figures have been quoted, tens of thousands. As many as 30,000 people could have been killed on January 8th and 9th alone. That's what some senior officials of the Ministry of Health in Iran have told Time magazine. Let us talk, though, to Gonche Habibiazad, a BBC Persian reporter in London, who's with me in the studio. And Gonche, what are you hearing about the situation, the intensity of protest and the repression of that protest?
Currently, Iran has been paused for 18 days of internet shutdown, which has been the longest and the most severe one in Iran's history. And the internet monitoring platform NetBlocks has said that there has been some brief connectivity spikes that give the false impression of a wide restoration, while this has not been the case. I've been talking to my friends and family in Tehran, and what they're saying is that their lives has been impacted, and it's the situation that's going on. And some of them had small businesses and online shops as well. You know, like, Iran is under Western sanctions, and you do have Amazon or other like platforms in Iran that you can easily buy from, and you have to import into the country, and that requires internet. And Iran's communication minister has said that the internet blackout is causing an estimated damage of about 34 million a day to Iran's economy. And it's been really difficult to get a full picture of what's going on inside the country right now with the internet outage.
Do you feel, as you understand it, that protests are continuing, or have the authorities managed to hose them down, really, with this internet blackout and a lot of violence against protesters?
From what I'm hearing, the protests are no longer happening, but so many families have lost their loved ones during the protests. I've been hearing that there are black banners on almost every street in Tehran, black banners indicating that someone has died on that street. And, you know, every time that the protest happens, people have been telling me that the deaths and the number of that like comes closer to home. Like, before that it was like cousin of a cousin, a friend of a friend, but this time it's like a father of one of my friends has died during these protests, and it's getting closer and closer to home.
Thank you for that, Gonche Habibiazad from BBC Persian. Well, Masih Ahmadinejad is an influential Iranian activist exiled in New York. She has millions of followers on social media and is seen as a thorn in the side of the Iranian regime, in fact, sometimes called public enemy number one. I spoke to her earlier. She told me what she was hearing from the people she's in touch with inside Iran.
They are telling me that what they are witnessing, it's unimaginable for people outside Iran. A massacre is unfolding in Iran, and more than 30,000 innocent people, unarmed people, defenseless people, have been killed in front of the eyes of their family members. And my source telling me that right now they are storming into doctors' houses. You know, after when they have killed thousands of people, then they started to storm into hospital and finishing off the injured one. This is a crime against humanity. My heart is broken when people inside Iran telling me, Masih, please help us. Please tell the world that we are stuck here and we are getting killed and we need help. Save us.
And are the authorities succeeding in suppressing the demonstrations and the protests, or are those protests still occurring on a nightly basis?
Of course, when they have military weapons, they can push back the people to go to their house for a short period. But as far as I hear from Iranians inside, the anger is still there. And believe me, they will get back to the street. And I strongly believe that the next wave will be much heavier.
Now, a US aircraft carrier has arrived in the Middle East that we've heard from the US military. President Trump has said help is coming. Now, that was some time ago, and nothing has really happened very significantly since then from the United States. What are you expecting? What are you seeking the US government, the US military to do?
It's not me seeking. It's the people inside Iran who welcomed the forceful message of President Trump. Because for years and years, we have seen the US president always appeasing to the regime. People are now saying words matter. They want to see that President Trump, the US, targeting, calculated, targeted action against the killers, against IRGC, against Ali Khamenei, against all of those who ordering massacre and mass killings. That's what the people of Iran expect.
I mean, it is interesting you're saying that, and that there would be widespread support for American intervention in Iran. I mean, President Trump, well, he has intervened in Venezuela, but he hasn't engaged in regime change, and he doesn't seem to be interested in nation building and saving the world from dictators. And I wonder whether you think he is interested in doing what you've just described.
Look, we are interested. We, the people of Iran, are interested to end this regime. I am in touch with Maria Corina Machado, with Leopoldo Lopez, and all the other opposition leaders in Venezuela. They welcomed the capture of Maduro. And this is the first step. The first and immediate and urgent help is needed. But I don't think that we should just call on the United States to protect unarmed people. Where are the G7 leaders? Where is Prime Minister of the United Kingdom? Why don't you cut the diplomatic ties with a regime that massacring people? We believe that this is at the time that the G7 leaders must be as united as dictators.
Do you have in mind what would replace the current regime in Iran if it was toppled? I mean, obviously, there is a son of the Shah living in the United States, and there are those who say that would be the obvious kind of replacement system of government. What is your view about what happens in the world that you want, which is that this regime is sent packing?
I strongly believe that fair and free election, a secular democracy, is the answer to this barbaric regime. I keep hearing in the West many times people saying that it is very dangerous. What is going to replace this regime? Really? Kidding me? I mean, the real threat and danger is the same regime. It's the Islamic Republic. So after that, we will have a transition from dictatorship to democracy, and then fair and free election will let the rest of the world know that Iranians are ready to have an election and choose the kind of government that they want to have.
You're very, very passionate about this, Massey. You're living in the United States and you're affected by the Iranian regime, even in the United States. Tell us about what's been happening, because I think there's a court case coming up this week in which you will meet someone who was essentially there to kill you.
This is the second one, actually. Yes, that's the reason that I am passionate about it, because it's my life. I have been facing the same terrorist myself. I'm not just an outsider. I have faced these assassins. I've seen them with my own eyes in front of my garden in Brooklyn. I have seen a man with AK-47, Russian mobster, was hired by the regime to kill me. These Russian mobsters received 25 years prison sentence last October. And guess what? Now, Wednesday, January 28th, I'm going to federal court again to face another man who was hired by IRGC to kill me at Fairfield University in Connecticut, where I was scheduled to give a talk. You see, this is the regime that I'm talking. Transnational repression became a tool in their hand to target the dissidents and their opponents beyond their own borders. First, they massacre people inside Iran. Then they shut down the internet to cover up. And then they target people like me outside Iran who try to expose their brutality. This is an ISIS in power with oil. If I was not protected by the US, I could have been killed. 3 times I survived. That's why I need the same protection for my people, for my unarmed and defenseless people.
Masih Alinejad, the Iranian activist in New York, explaining what she thinks is going on inside Iran and how the regime affects her life. 14 minutes to six. Now let's have a last look at some other headlines. Here's Ron.
10 European countries, including the UK, have signed a deal to build a vast new fleet of offshore wind projects in the North Sea. The High Court has ordered Saudi Arabia to pay more than £3 million to a prominent human rights activist, Ghanem Al-Masarir, who was attacked in London in 2018 and had spyware installed on his phones. The judge ruled in his favour, finding that Saudi Arabia has no real prospect of defending the claim. And weather warnings have been issued ahead of Storm Chandra, which is to hit the UK tomorrow.
Thank you, Ron. Now, it's Monday, which is the day upon which we sporadically take a look at the world of AI, and Zoe Kleinman joins us to offer thoughts and guidance on the use, misuse and abuse of the popular chatbots. And today, Zoe, and I don't know who suggested this first, but we wanted to talk about the afterlife. Yes. And how AI can assist in that. So why don't you take us through what has become definitely a feature, which is people, if you like, rebuilding someone who has passed as a personality online.
Let me tell you two words, grief bots and death bots. If you've heard of them before, it's kind of using artificial intelligence to try to bring back someone who you've lost, the essence of them, I suppose, to get a chatbot to talk to you in the way that that person would have done it. Now, it is an ethical minefield, as you can imagine, but it is now technically possible. What you need, if you want to do it, is data. You need as many recordings, videos, WhatsApp messages, emails, everything that you can get hold of, really, from the person who you've lost. If it is someone who's coming to the end of their life and they want to consent to it, then obviously, ideally, you want to capture these recordings specifically. Consent, I think, is really important. If you can't have a conversation with them directly, then I think you need to have a conversation with the family and decide whether it's okay for you to do it. You can either employ tools. There are companies that make tools specifically to do it for you. Some will do text chat only. Some will recreate videos. Or you can sort of use one of the many chatbots that are available to everybody.
Right. And we should say there was an episode of Black Mirror that literally created a sort of AI robotic replacement of someone who was killed in a car accident and was felt very dysfunctional. Zoe, we did have a lot of emails about this when we went out for it. So Vivek says in Spain, there's an entertaining program called Regreso AI Presente, which means return to the present, where they get AI to play a historic figure and two presenters hold an interview with them. And they interview people like Napoleon Bonaparte, Charles Dickens, Lyndon B. Johnson, which shows the technology can do this. You just feed it lots of stuff, the voice, the views, the WhatsApp messages or whatever. AI is perfectly capable of creating a character. But do we know? Do we know whether this is considered a good way of grieving? I guess that would be, I'm not a grief expert or a psychologist. Is that a good way of letting go of somebody or saying farewell to somebody?
No, I'm not a grief expert either, but I think it's probably very individual, isn't it, to every person. And I guess in a way, you don't know until you do it. Some people say they've done it and they found it's given them incredible feelings of closure and they've loved having either a long-standing bit of tech that they can talk to that brings them back to the person that they've lost. Other people say, actually, they did it and they couldn't bear it. This is very low-tech, Evan, but I've got some home videos that my dad made when I was a child. He died a long time ago, and I watched some with my mum, and there's one in which he tells me that he loves me, and honestly, I haven't spoken to him in nearly 20 years, and it moved me to tears, and that was just a very lo-fi hearing somebody's voice again. So I think you really do need to think about whether you will be prepared for it and how you will cope with it.
Yeah, I mean, Peter emailed and said, I use AI to generate video from old family photos. Now, that is an interesting one. He said, I've generated my christening in 1958.
Yes, I've seen that.
The thing about it is, you know that it isn't real. I mean, you know, it's a very personal thing. You're looking at it. You know that it's AI's best guess as to what it might have looked like. It doesn't mean it was really like that. I guess if you're going into this kind of thing very, very aware and you know what you're doing, it might have some value.
Yes, I think so. I mean, there are lots of people who try to, put family members into, say, wedding photos or, as you said, christening, who weren't alive at the time, but they like to feel that they were included in the day. And I mean, is it harmful if it's what you want to do and it feels good? I think, lots of people are going to be exploring it, definitely. I asked ChatGPT whether it would do it specifically, and it said it would, but only within the course of one conversation because it can't remember a personality and keep it. And it says you need to give it guardrails, what you don't want it to talk about. Do you want it to talk in the first person? And how do you want it to handle powerful emotions?
Really. And then Mike emailed to say China and South Korea have really popularized this. Zoe, thank you very much for that. And in a different realm, you can, of course, use AI to help you write your will, which it will do very, I don't know how legally binding it is or how legally careful it is, but certainly to help you.
It's a good start.
Thanks, Zoe. Now, it's 100 years since John Logie Baird first public demonstrated his novel television invention in Soho in London. An early version of the product, it was mechanical rather than electronic. Baird, incidentally, is not seen as the inventor of the television in the United States. But here he definitely is, and it was 100 years ago today he publicly demonstrated it. And I guess along with aeroplanes, modern computing and penicillin, it was one of the defining inventions of the 20th century. And it's one that's evolved over the decades as well. Let's just have a little taste of early TV. This was following the broadcast of the UK's first television play, The Man with the Flower in His Mouth, 1930.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Is that how they did it? Well, Verity Burns is a technology journalist and gadget reviewer who's just come back from the Consumer Electronics Show, a big annual show of new products over in the US. And David Hendy's an emeritus professor in media and cultural history at the University of Sussex, author of the BBC A People's History. David, can we just go back to John Logie Baird? Why is he not regarded as the inventor of television in the US? I know countries are a little bit nationalistic about their choice of heroes, but what's the story about what he did and what the US did?
Well, there were lots of people thinking about the idea of television for many years before this public demonstration in 1926. Experimenters in France, in the Soviet Union, yes, in America as well. What John Logie Baird brought to the event was that he introduced a kind of really basic mechanical device that kind of worked in a very primitive way. I mean, wooden boxes, cardboard tubes, rotating discs and sort of wires everywhere. But it worked. And of course, doing it in London, in Britain at that time, was a good place to succeed because there was a lot of commercial backing that was available. And ultimately, even though the BBC was a little bit wary at first, there was, in the end, the BBC that backed it. Not necessarily the Baird version, but it backed the idea of television. Okay. And it had one eye on the Americans, and they were developing an electronic version that involved cathode ray tubes. But it was the BBC willing to take on the risk of broadcasting television regularly in the 1930s, even though there wasn't much of an audience that really sustained television in those fragile early days.
And just in the history of it, it's post, would you say it's cultural impact? It's clearly post-war, really. Radio up until the war, television begins to take over after the war.
Yes, it only really becomes a mass medium in Britain in the 1950s, globally a little bit later. And, you know, it's at that point when you have millions of viewers and it's a broad working class audience, not just 10,000 people in the London area, that it starts to become not just a sort of shared experience in national life, but of course it also starts to become an object where people project a lot of their anxieties about is it going to rot our brains? Is it going to destroy regional cultures? Is it going to ruin domestic duties? Are people going to neglect cleaning and housework and so on? So, you know, all of these anxieties crop up as soon as it becomes a mass medium. And actually, it takes sociologists going into the housing estates of Essex and London and talking to people and discovering that actually it wasn't destroying social life at all. It was actually fostering conversation and family life.
People were sitting around the TV. It was together time. I was always brought up on it's chewing gum for the eyes. You shouldn't watch very much of it, but you can have it on for an hour. Verity, let's talk about where the technology has been going, because it used to be with a big funny cable and wire thing on the roof, which we called an aerial. But a lot of people don't bother with the aerial now. It's just a piece of cable coming in the house.
Absolutely. I think it's how we consume TV is affecting what the future of TV is going to look like. As you say, I've just come back from CES, and we've had a lot of some flashy sci-fi looking kind of TV concepts and things that have come to reality, like 3D TV 15 years ago was really the big thing and something that most manufacturers got behind and thought it was going to succeed. And 2 years in, it sort of flopped and became nothing again. And I think that was just because it was really focused on this tech first idea. And it didn't really think about how people really wanted to consume TV. And, you know, our TVs are not just the black boxes in our living room anymore. They're coming everywhere with us. They're our phones, they're our tablets. There's the idea of, you know, these XR and VR headsets.
Well, look, Verity, that's what I wanted to ask you about. Are those going to take over? Because those are very much individual consumption. That isn't all sitting around the box, or it seems very different to me if I've got a headset. Is that where it's going?
It feels very alien to us right now, I think. You know, I got to try Samsung's new one out at CES and really experience. I was watching Netflix, Stranger Things, and it felt absolutely enormous, this screen that I was watching. It was like IMAX size, you know, it was so, so immersive. And it did feel a little bit silly at the moment, but it feels like something that could take off in the coming years. And obviously with AI becoming more and more into our devices and personalizing our experience of TV, it is becoming less about, you know, us all gathering around the TV on a Saturday night and watching Doctor Who, as I remember when I was a child.
Individual consumption. Look, Verity, thanks so much for that. Verity Burns and David Hendy, television, past and present. Now, let's get past, present and future. Let us get some weather, though, now, future-focused. And today it is... Sorry, I need to get my script page. It's Chris Ford.
Yes. Oh, yes, me. Yeah. Hi, Evan. We've got Storm Chandra on the way. That's going to be causing some problems overnight tonight and tomorrow as well. Ground saturated across southwest England, and with more rain expected, the Met Office have put out an amber weather warning that's valid throughout the night up till 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. An additional 30 to 50 millimetres on the way, but 80 over the hills. Some flooding is likely to affect parts of rivers, and also groundwater flooding is a possibility. So I think that's the first hazard that Storm Chandra will bring us. For the rest of the UK, it will be quite a wet and a windy night with outbreaks of rain spreading into many areas. Bumping into cold air, we're looking at a spell of hill snow over the peaks in the Pennines and ultimately into parts of Scotland for tomorrow as well. I think the worst of the conditions are going to be quite high up in the hills, say above 400 metres elevation, but if you are travelling across some of those higher level routes, you know, the Snake Pass, the A66, maybe the M62, could be worth checking on weather conditions before heading out on your journey. There could be some disruption due to snow. Into tomorrow, we're looking at wet and windy weather extending into many areas of the UK. It'll also become windy for a time. Gusts reach around 60 to 70 miles an hour for the Isles of Scilly and later in Northern Ireland, where the Met Office have an amber wind warning for parts of Antrim and Down. Could cause one or two issues here. Evan.
Chris, thank you for that. That was Chris Fawkes. Chris Lovelock was our studio director today, and Jonathan Harvey was our editor.